was for heat for many, many years. And as always, it's humbling to sit here. I'd also like to thank another one of my very important teachers, Brother David Steindl-Rast. Is this okay? It's not working. Check. Is it working? Is it working now? All right. So, the Mountains and Water Sutra was, according to Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation in Moon in a Dewdrop, taught to the assembly at Kanandori Ko Shohoren Monastery on the 18th day of the 10th month in the year 1240 in the Common Era at the hour of the rat. Which, from my experience with rats, I'm going to guess it was between about 2:30 and 3:30 in the morning. And I've been studying the sutra and working with it in two different translations, this and also in Nishijima and Cross's Volume 1, Shobo Genzo. And sutra, it's called, a lot of Dogen's writings are called fascicles. And this is called a fascicle too, but it's also called a sutra. And as a sutra is called such because it's considered direct expression of the Buddha's enlightenment. It's a very interesting sutra. Mountains and waters right now are the actualization of the ancient Buddha way, each abiding in its phenomenal expression realizes completeness. Mountains and waters right now are the actualization of the ancient Buddha way, each abiding in its phenomenal expression realizes completeness. Priest Daokai of Mount Furong said to the assembly, "The green mountains are always walking." And great master Huang Zhen of Yunnan said, "Eastern mountains travel on water." The green mountains are always walking. Eastern mountains travel on water. So this highly poetic imagery, Dogen says, was considered by certain groups of practitioners in his time to be necessary to expound the Dharma, because enlightenment was so profound that it can only be expressed in imagery that goes beyond understanding. And so in his time, he said there were groups of, he calls them careless fellows and bald-headed rascals, who regarded only illogical presentations that were unconcerned with thought somehow preceded the arising of form and logic as expressions of enlightenment. And Dogen said, "How sad that they don't know about the penetrating logic that's in these phrases and stories." He says their idea about illogical words is a distorted view. And maybe he reveals a little bit of his personality when he says, "When I laughed at them in China, they had no response and remained silent." So he goes on to say, this is not just metaphor. This is not some sort of symbolic construction. You should know that eastern mountains traveling on water is the bones and marrow of the Buddha ancestors. This is practice realization. Don't slander by saying that a green mountain cannot walk and an eastern mountain cannot travel on water. He goes on to say, when your understanding is shallow, you doubt the phrase, green mountains are walking. When your learning is immature, you're shocked by the words flowing mountains. And so, starting from this, and this is sort of how the sutra starts out, so right away I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be studying this in the usual way. I usually, I'm used to sort of an academic sort of mode of study where I read and I reflecting and I'm understanding and I'm underlining and taking notes and so forth. And so for this sutra, it was more so like, you know, I just had to sort of marinate it in it for a while and absorb it. And in fact, there was another book that I dearly love. Many of you know it, I'm sure. It's called Cultivating the Empty Field, The Silent Illumination of Zen Master Hongshur. He was practiced at the same monastery at Dogen, Mount Tiantong in China, 100 years before Dogen. So he was an ancestor of Dogen's. And he recommends Zazen as a method for studying. He says, an ancient said that non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. Wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So it's sort of less of a process of discriminative analysis and more of a process of just sort of gazing into beauty, sitting with it. I'm very fortunate and blessed to have a commute to my office every day that involves walking up on campus through along a bike path through a meadow that gains in elevation. And when I get to the top of it, especially since I've been studying this sutra, I get to the top of it and I turn around, and for about 180 degrees are the waters of the Monterey Bay and across the, you know, what could pass for mountains of the Monterey Peninsula. I don't think they're very high, but it's certainly a dramatic elevation change between the hills over there and the sea stretching out in all directions. I'm sure you've all seen this, like I have many times. But so I would turn around and I would look at it, I would stand there for a few minutes, and I'd say, the green mountains are walking, and the eastern mountains travel on water. And I just sort of look at them and I'd say, no, they're pretty much standing still. I don't see any walking going on there. Maybe if I squint, but, you know, it's so natural, I think, to want to rely on appearances and on sort of first perceptions or superficial perceptions or our own analysis, our past experience, when we're trying to look and directly perceive and experience reality. All of our habits and history really leads us to lean on our fixed views. No, I can't walk anywhere. So then many of us have been in mountains, and so I just, you know, consider for a moment, well, what is a mountain then? What is it? If it, you know, because you realize you're looking at something that's almost like a picture or scenery, but what is it really? And I thought, well, you know, I've been in the mountains before. There's grass, trees, rocks, stones, pebbles, walls, foxes. Maybe that's, you know, the heart of the mountain, the true mountain. Like Dogen says, even if you see mountains as grass, trees, earth, rocks, or walls, do not take this seriously or worry about it. It's not complete realization. And another way, you know, if we ask the geologist to look at a mountain, they would say, well, it's a process that emerges over time of the earth, of erosion or upheaval or minerals and stones and precious metals. And Dogen says, well, even if there's a moment when you view mountains as the seven treasures, gold, silver, lapis lazuli, he goes on to name them, the seven treasures shining, this is not returning to the source. This is not true understanding. Even if you adopt a spiritual lens and look at the mountains and say, well, they're a place of hermitage, a place of broad, clear view, clear perspective, unobstructed view. Even if you understand mountains as the realms where all the Buddhas practice, this understanding is not something to be attached to. Even if we say, in the end, there's some process to nature, to the mountains and waters, a manifestation that's inconceivable. It's in its complexity and function. Dogen says, even if you have the highest understanding of mountains, as all Buddhas, inconceivable qualities, the truth is not only this. These are conditioned views. This is not the understanding of Buddha ancestors. But just looking through a bamboo tube at a corner of the sky. I love that. Looking through a bamboo tube at the corner of the sky. Inconceivable itself is a conditioned view. And he says, don't let inconceivable be a dead end for you or an end point. You should not neglect studying the Buddha ancestors' path of enlightenment, even if it is beyond understanding in the end. Your present understanding is off the mark. So if any view that I hold of mountains and water, you know, I'm getting late for work now because I'm standing here and I'm just trying to, you know, figure this out. If any view that we hold of mountains and waters, or that I hold of mountains and waters, or self, or others, any view is conditioned, then what is unconditioned? What view is possibly unconditioned? Is any view unconditioned? Well, Dogen says mountains and waters are practice realization. So there must be a teaching here. There's a truth here, a revealed truth of undivided reality, and therefore of our own true nature, our Buddha nature. Kaz Ta-Nehisi says in his glossary that in Dogen's usage, he often refers to walking. Walking, as we all know, is one of the postures of meditation. We were just engaging in it a few minutes ago. Many of us were. He says in Dogen's usage, it also refers to continuous practice. And so he says, mountains do not lack the qualities of mountains. Therefore, they always abide in ease and always walk. So they continuously practice. Green mountains master walking. Eastern mountains master traveling on water. Accordingly, these activities are a mountain's practice, keeping its own form without changing body and mind. A mountain always practices in every place, keeping its own form without changing body and mind. A mountain always practices in every place. And he goes on to say, mountains walking, or mountains continuous practice, is just like humans walking. Accordingly, do not doubt that mountains walk, even though it does not look the same as humans walking. So what is this walking, this continuous practice of a mountain or of a human being? Well, he says, each abiding, mountains and waters, each abiding in its phenomenal expression realizes completeness, realizes its true nature. Many times we've heard in talks that the self... the self is not fixed, the self is not permanent, the self is not separate, and the self doesn't have a place to abide. The self sort of abides nowhere. Well, here he's saying each, you know, mountains, water, self, other, abides in its phenomenal expression, realizing completeness, its true nature. So again, you know, I spent a lot of time with this glossary, which, let me tell you, the print is really small. And if you go... like, there's a little star as an asterisk, and it takes you to the glossary, and then that one says, see something else. And then you go to that one, and it says, see something. It's really, you know, you got to be patient. It's a good practice. Anyway, when I finally tracked down what he was talking about by phenomenal expression, he says, literally translated as Dharma position, the unique, non-repeatable stage of a thing's existence at any given moment. Also, C, expression complete this moment, a state of being itself at each moment, which carries entire time, each moment. Phenomenal expression is subjective. It's from within. It's experienced from within. It's not defined or described by an observer. Dogen says in Genjo Koan, to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves as enlightenment. It's a phenomenal expression. But most of the time, I know I do this, it's very easy to operate from fixed views and privilege our own view at the center, rather than understanding that there's a continual array of phenomenal expression coming forward to meet us in every moment. It's difficult to go beyond these appearances, projections, assumptions, and interpretations we make about others. I'm always deferring to my fixed views. If I hold a view of myself and somebody says something to me and it doesn't match my fixed view, I say, oh, well, they don't really know me. They don't understand. Or if I hold a fixed view of someone else and some evidence comes in to contradict that fixed view, I say, well, that's, forget about it. They really are this way. So I think, you know, it's a tendency to, we want certainty. We want to define and predict reality. But if a self or a water or a mountain is just continually arising, experiencing itself, then what would that look like? So anyways, I had kind of an interesting little experience. Chuck, I told you you were going to have a little cameo in my talk. And on Sesshin, some of us were sending Sesshin in here last weekend for a few days. And after a couple days, Chuck and I were serving together. We were standing behind the altar, kind of where Nanette is, but really right behind the altar. And sort of concealed behind the altar. And this is the position where the servers stand and wait for everybody to get their bowls out and sort of get settled. And we're waiting for the clackers to come in and wipe down the meal boards. These first part of the tons where we're gonna set our food. And so Chuck was the head server, so he was more or less paying attention to what was happening. So I was just looking at Chuck. And I've been sort of dwelling on this sutra for about several months now, and this whole idea of phenomenal expression was just sort of arising. And I thought, well, what is Chuck really? I mean, there he is, but what is he? And I thought, well, you know, he's a son, he's a partner, he's a grandfather, he's a Dharma friend, he's an artist, a farmer. A serving partner, a comedian. So you might not know Chuck's a comedian. Right before we came in to serve, we were in the kitchen, and the Tenzo, who was Lori, is Lori here? Who was our Tenzo? And she was taking the food out of the oven, which was some muffins, and turning to hand to Chuck, and she said, muffins. And Chuck just looked at me, he goes, did she just call me muffins? I said, yeah, I think that should be your name from now on. So Muffins and I were back there. And, but I was thinking, these are just my views of Chuck. You know, I'm sort of rolling through them like a little Rolodex, one after the other. But to other people, Chuck is, you know, maybe that same day, Chuck was some guy driving a truck on the road too slow that wouldn't get out of the way, you know. Or maybe he was somebody who grew a tomato that they bought. Or maybe he was somebody that somebody wanted to recruit for a design their petition or whatever. There's millions and millions of views of people that come from every direction all the time. In fact, everyone in this room has their own Chuck. At this moment, at the next moment, at the next moment. So, but his phenomenal expression, each of us, our phenomenal expression can only be, it's this unfolding moment to moment multiplicity from within ourselves. So there I was, sort of looking. And I thought, I'm not going to try and understand Chuck. I'm just going to look at him. And I looked at him, and when I was trying to just breathe and watch, and you can try this with a person sometime or with anything. Really, what started to come forward more was sort of a felt stream of impression. Not even really in words, just like form. Activity, energy within a bounded form, but changing moment to moment, sort of a flash of a little boy, a flowing stream of time, just, you know, years accumulating, years and experience. And there we were behind the altar. And this was just flowing, just unfolding every second, and just so then just what arose spontaneously was just a deep appreciation and affection and just a sense of awe for this being, the shifting space, unfolding of time in the shifting space, right? So it was really awesome. But don't let it go to your head, Muffin. It probably was the mushrooms that Yarrow put in her soup the night before. It was a true sort of psychedelic experience. But it was great. It was this glimpse, I think, of what we all are. And what we, for convenience sake, what the mountains are too, and what waters are too, and what ourself is too. For convenience sake, we sort of adopt these labels and fixed views. But we're seeing things from different perspectives all the time, and putting our own experience and our own views on them. All beings do not see mountains and waters in the same way. Some beings see water as a jeweled ornament. Some beings see water as wondrous blossoms. Dragons see water as a palace or pavilion. Now, when dragons and fish see water as a palace, it's just like human beings seeing a palace. They do not think it flows. If an outsider tells them, what you see as a palace is running water, the dragons and fish will be astonished, just as we are when we hear the words, mountains flow. Thus, what is seen does indeed differ according to the kind of being that sees. Now, let us be wary of this. Is it that there are various ways of seeing one object? Or is it that we have mistakenly assumed the various images to be one object? If this is so, then practice and experience, the pursuit of truth, may not be of one kind. It may be not of two kinds. It may be of thousands of kinds and myriads of kinds. Many, many, many practice realizations. Many, many manifestations. A kaleidoscope of expression. But our views are fixed, such as when we look at a mountain and it appears to have one form and a stationary form. So I think from studying with this, it's been really worthwhile for me to question, to learn, to remind myself to question what is real when it comes to self or others, and especially if there are strong emotions arising that can obscure reality or lead me into a fixed view. Most of the time, I think, as a habit, I'm assuming I have, maybe you guys do this too, I assume I have an accurate or correct view of what I'm experiencing with myself and other people. I assume I'm seeing and experiencing things the way they are, that there's some kind of reality there. Yet things as they are, or Suzuki Roshi said things as it is, are entirely free of that seeing. And a self is also entirely free, liberated, of seeing one's own self. So that seeing or understanding and reality can be, reality doesn't depend on that seeing and understanding. So to remember this, I saw in one of the other footnotes in here reminded me of the story of Minister Shea's love for a dragon. This is a charming little story. Minister Shea's love for a dragon. Minister Shea had a great fascination for dragons. So, you know, he's sort of a collector. He had scrolls with dragons on them and dragons embroidered on his robes and teacups, dragons. And it's like your friend, the one friend you have who collects elephants, you know, and once people find out, they're always giving their friend elephants. So Minister Shea had a lot of dragons. Minister Shea had a great fascination for dragons. Having heard this, a dragon came down from the sky. And the dragon thought, this is my people, you know, we're going to have a great conversation. He's really into dragons. Having heard this, a dragon came down from the sky and appeared at Mr. Shea's window. When Mr. Shea saw the dragon, he ran away and fainted. So, what we think we know, or what we think we love, or what we think we understand, oftentimes it's what we're encountering is our own mind. Minister Shea in his love for dragon was encountering his own mind. He wasn't encountering a real dragon when he did. It kind of blew him away. I think this is true in everyday conventional encounters that, you know, I have, probably you do too, countless of them every day. However, just like the dragon in the story, others and self and mountains and water are free. And Dogen Kaz says that, Kaz Ta-Nehisi, the translator, just as Dogen uses water to walking to talk about continuous practice, he uses water oftentimes to represent thusness, which is truth as it is, reality, things as they are, not as we think they are, not as a jade dragon, but a real dragon, not as we imagine them to be. So, and Dogen says, but water, if you think about for thusness, but water, what really is, for various kinds of beings that see it and relate to it, does not depend on mind or body, does not arise from actions, does not depend on self or other. Water's freedom depends only on water. And he gave his monks this instruction. For the present, we should learn and practice the moments in which it's possible to put on the eyes and look in the 10 directions of the water of the 10 directions. And when it's possible to put on the eyes and look in the 10 directions at the water of the 10 directions, to look in a way that encompasses reality, maybe he's hinting at that. This is not learning in practice only of the time when human beings and gods see water. This is learning in practice of water seeing water. Because water practices and experiences water. There's the manifestation in practice of water speaking water. Because reality practices and experiences reality, thusness experiencing thusness. There's the manifestation in practice of reality speaking reality, of thusness speaking itself. We should manifest in reality the path on which self encounters self. We should advance and retreat along the path in which the external world exhausts the external world, and we should spring free. So, yes.
At this juncture, a question comes to mind. Should I wait for you to finish your...
Let's wait.
Okay.
Because I'm sort of in the flow.
Okay.
Do you mind waiting?
Not at all.
Okay. I'm sort of formulating in the juncture.
Good.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm just going to talk for a little bit more and about this relationship between the mountains and the waters. All mountains walk, practice with their toes on all waters and splash there. You can see this for yourself in the Monterey Bay. Walking beyond and walking within are both done on water. Walking beyond, practicing, continuous practice, walking beyond oftentimes hints at coming forth, bringing forth, coming forth in the world, and walking backward often refers to advancing inward. So he says, walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. This is called the mountain's flow and the flowing mountains. And in the world, water manifests when sky and clouds and mountains interact, and snow and rain and rivers and streams and lakes and ponds and oceans form around the mountains. And so the mountains practice, it manifests water, which realizes itself. And for human beings, it's the same. The practice enlightenment is practicing, manifesting, bringing forth the Buddha Dharma, which realizes itself in practice. I'll just read you a couple little beautiful descriptions of this to from Master Hong Shur's Cultivating the Empty Field. A person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountain appears. The moon sets and the water is cool. Every bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. So maybe the study of mountains and waters is a glimpse into vast interpenetration without bounds. And maybe the practice realization, the continuous walking, the continuous practice beyond and within of mountains and waters and human beings is a vast interpenetration without bounds of the absolute, the source, and the relative, the manifest, such that the continuous practice of reality as source giving rise to mountains and waters and human beings and interpenetrating mountains and waters and human beings and becoming this manifest reality in these forms, which then this manifest reality itself, in accord with its own truth, its own thusness, continually practices reality, realizing itself. Therefore, investigate mountains thoroughly. When you investigate mountains thoroughly, this is the work of the mountains. And such mountains and waters of themselves become wise persons and sages. And I'll just end by another sort of caution or instruction or invitation from Dogen. Explaining the mind and explaining true nature is not agreeable to Buddha ancestors. Seeing into mind and seeing into true nature is the activity of people outside of the way. Set words and phrases are not the words of liberation. There is something free from all of these understandings. Green mountains always walk, and eastern mountains travel on water. You should study this in detail. So I think I'll end there if we want to have some discussion. Maybe I'll invite you first, Richard, if you'd like to. Or we can, somebody else, if you prefer not. Anybody else? Like to share a thought or a comment? An anecdote? Dana. When I go to work, I keep walking. You know, it's really become sustaining for me, I have to say, in the sense of sort of opening, more freedom, sort of around the landscape of thought about self and other, and about the whole fabric of deep ecology, you know, human beings and nature. And I just think the admonition to continuously practice and to continuously, we can't really see, but continuously be present to thusness as it arises, I think it's very relevant for any work practice, and mine included. I thought of you with Minister Shea, because I thought of how whenever I have penguin things, I bring them to you. Dana's a penguin collector. Have you ever seen her? Has one ever appeared at your window? Not yet. Yeah. Jean. Yeah, a phenomenal expression. It's, well, I was sort of relying, I don't know if this is, you know, 100% in accord, but I was sort of relying on phenomenology as defined by Western philosophy, or by philosophy, which is a subjective experience of reality rather than an experience that can be captured by description or observation outside of the actual experience. So it's subjective. It's a dance that I enact that can only be experienced from within the dance. But it can be witnessed, and one can be present to it, to one's within one experiences it, but one can be present to another's. But the self, Dogen saying that this is where the self is completely realized in this continual phenomenal expression. Mountains, waters, and human beings.
And now I'm struggling to reconcile that with your description of Chuck Muffin. When you had, it took you probably 4 or 5 minutes to describe what probably occurred in 2 or 3 seconds. So Chuck Muffin became the slow of human.
Yeah, I sort of tried to let drop away all the fixed views that I had of Chuck. I mean, I didn't have to work really hard at it because we had already been sitting Sesshin for 2 days. So there was like a whole Zazen sort of context. It's really hard to do that with a person just in regular interaction. To say like, oh, you know, you're just, you know, you're somebody who annoys me every day. That's how I see you, you know. you know, or whatever it is. Well, I felt like it was almost a little taste of the myriad things coming forward and experiencing themselves. So that it wasn't truly subject-object. I mean, there was one reality arising, but it was a little bit of that shift of figure ground when rather than me experiencing Chuck, I had a little glimpse of Chuck experiencing himself. In through my sort of just being present to it. I'm sure the experience was completely different for Chuck. We should probably check in with him. Richard, thank you for indulging me before and with your granting me your patience.
That's an important question to ask you, and I really respect that.
Thank you.
Present that moment was is this a contradiction stating that phenomena is always subjective? And then having some idea even of things coming forward and expressing themselves when in my sense of our practice, there's also the idea that there is no self. So what is coming forward and expressing what? And in a way, just to answer that, then to let you respond to me, the reason I would read it alone after you finish is because the wonder in our practice seems to be that everything, in the sense of yin and yang, everything is always literal and metaphorical at the same time. Constantly, I can never, you can never pull it apart. So if it makes sense, then it's time to start learning almost, So the fact that you said something that later doesn't mesh, that one part of me wants to say, but you said this and this. And then I finally settle down after you finish, and the water settle, and I say, well, of course they don't necessarily. They might contradict each other and should. So I would be quiet, but I need you to respond to that. Then you can respond.
Okay. Well, I think, it's a deep question about what is coming forward. When we say, myriad things are coming forward and experiencing themselves, if there is no self, then what is it? But there's something. There's something happening. We know something's happening in this room right now. We might not know exactly what it is. We might look around and say, well, it's a bunch of scenery, kind of like, looking at a mountain. But there's something really deep happening. And there's continuous experience unfolding, moment to moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, which is maybe the closest that we could come to saying abiding in phenomenal expression. And one as one way, wandering into the circle of wonder.
I love that.
That's a great book. Cultivating the Empty Field. Let's say if the desert island question, and let's say the Shobo Genzo is a given, Cultivating the Empty Field is the other book I take. I love the book. It's a dear, dear book. Yeah. And I think this is what Dogen said right at the beginning of the sutra. He said, hey, there's a sort of a sense that, well, of course, it doesn't make sense. It's beyond logic. It's profound. But and then he goes on to say, even in the end, if that's true, there's some very deep penetrating logic here. So he's holding the two things just as you are. He was 40 years old when he gave this talk. He probably had no contemporaries or peers that understood even what he was talking about. And, just it's amazing, when I laughed at them in China, they had no words for me. Wild. Probably have time for one. Liz.
Thank you for speaking on this topic and sharing your process with it. Just in this relaxed way, kind of walking us through how it became meaningful to you. And also your ability to recognize that very human experience of the way in which we hold on to our fixed views kind of differently with ourselves and with others. So, it's very common.
Yeah, I would almost say that from day to day, since, especially in the last few months since I've been really studying this, that I've noticed more and more and more and more the suffering caused by my fixed views. And it's really painful suffering because it's not so easy to let go of your fixed views. I mean, they're fixed. Right? So it's like these specks of dust. It's like, okay, the whole process can be unencumbered. There are a lot of specks of dust, but, without partnering. with the specks of dust, the whole process arises without a trace. So maybe it's not necessarily like I have to eliminate a fixed view. It's just like, okay, there it is. If you can get to that point. Now, it's hard. He says in another place, in Cultivating the Empty Field, check this out. Spacious and content, without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping, effectively overcome habitual behavior and realize the self that is not possessed by emotions. To which, you know, I say, good luck to myself. You know, realize the self that is not possessed by emotions. Good luck, you know. Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because he doesn't say it's not that you don't have emotions, it's that you're just not possessed.
Not possessed. It's like the whole, it's like the specks of dust. He's not saying you better get rid of specks of dust. He's saying, you know, I don't want to misquote, but the deep source, transparent to the bottom, can radiantly shine and respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. So sort of a skillful means type of like, okay, source manifesting as natural as stream flowing down a mountain. So we're at time to stop. Thank you all so much for this opportunity and for your presence and for being here. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.